The governor appoints the commissioners and...
The governor received the recommendations from various people and makes that judgment in, on his own.
Why do you think you were chosen?
I was recommended by the executive director, then Galen Martin, who's been an extremely active person in civil rights. He was a Berea College graduate about 4 years before I graduated, and he called me and said there was a vacancy and asked if I would be interested, and I told him I would.
How, did you know Galen at, I guess he had left Berea by the time you got there, is that correct?
That's correct. He left a year before I got there, but I had come to know him through some alumni matters.
Okay. Did you have any second thoughts about this at all? Was this something you...
No, it was always something that I had an interest in. Grew up in a segregated community, except where we resided, there were blacks and whites because we were on the lower economic, social economics, and I always had lots of friends who were black, and I never could understand. We could play together all summer, and then we went off to different schools. And couldn't understand that in football, for example, we could play the Ohio schools, but they couldn't bring their black players to Kentucky. We usually won when we played them in Kentucky because their best players weren't playing. I never could understand how a coach could ask his players to practice all week and then couldn't play because of something to do with skin color.
Did you play on the football team?
No.
That you saw this happening?
Well, I saw that happening, and I knew that it was happening, and the young men that I dealt with knew that. On the other hand, at Ashland Senior High School, which had always been segregated, of course, they had one of the leading things that happened there each year was the senior minstrel show. And so they took eight men in blackface and white men, put you in blackface, and then they had musical background of that. You told jokes, and you told those jokes in dialect. And I've always felt badly because I participated in that, not thinking much about it. And I remember following that. At least our minstrel, we apparently had told some off-color stories. The next day, the Ministerial Association, I guess, in the community met and talked to our sponsor, and she asked me to come in along with some others. She was very supportive because she knew these were in the thing. And I found that they were very upset. The Ministerial Association were very upset about some off-color stories that had nothing to do with race. But they didn't raise no single question about us making and belittling our friends. And since that time, when my children come home and they look at the annual and they see that I'm involved in that, it's one of those things that I feel like I've had to apologize for. Then, of course, I went on to Berea, and Berea was just in the midst of reintegrating, since they couldn't have done that since the early 1900s under the Day Law of Kentucky. And I found at Berea a situation where integration was not only tolerated, it was celebrated. And it was the only place I'd ever been that said, look, this is what we ought to be doing, and it's best for all of us to do that. And, of course, Berea was founded as a integrated school in the Civil War times, and it was run off those ridges of Berea because the integrated always has been. So I think that was a big turning point. One, I had friends whom I sensed were not being treated correctly. Blacks could not swim in the swimming pool in Ashland at that time. They could swim in the swimming pool in Ironton, but only on the last day before the pool was cleaned. And as I thought back on some of those things, in particular that area at Berea College where this was celebrated, I became, I guess during that period of time, quite an advocate for those rights and took part in matters involving them.
Well, since you were there when Berea reintegrated after such a long, almost about a 50-year hiatus.
That's correct.
What was that like? Give me an explanation of the feeling on campus.
The feeling on campus was pretty good, frankly. The feeling in the town was not. These students still could not go to the theaters in town, and finally while I was there, they could go upstairs to the theaters. Students would come. I knew one friend who came to Berea from Africa, and he was converted to Christianity in Africa, but he went to, he was Baptist, and he went to the Baptist Church in Berea, and the congregation did not permit him to become a member, although he was converted by Baptist missionaries in his native. I had friends who were black on the debate team, and we traveled places where we would stop to eat, and they wouldn't serve our friends, so they didn't serve us either. The first black basketball player, college basketball player in Berea, in Kentucky at that time, was at Berea, a fellow who just recently died. And,
do you remember his name?
Yeah, his name was, you'll find it, you'll find a large write-up in the last year or so, Stokes, and he was from Richmond, and he played, and Berea won the championship that year, but during the course of that, I found that even Berea College, with its deal, and I was president of student government, so I found that Berea was renting some apartments and permitting discrimination in those apartments, and also was renting some on College Square, some buildings which did not serve blacks. So I took that up with the administration as well as in my position as president of student government, so we got a lot of things even made better during that period.
Did you get cooperation once you raised the issue with the administration?
Yeah, I got interesting comments. I remember Dean Smith, who was a wonderful fellow, and he would tell me, he said, David, you're in your last year here. You've got to get these things done. I've been here far too long, and I'm far too patient. By working together, we'll get some of these things done. And they were receptive, but they were embarrassed to have some of the publicity that we gave them at that time of our alma mater.
Okay, well, let's talk a little bit more about the Commission on Human Rights. You know, at least prior to 1966, I think, was when the state passed the Civil Rights Act.
That's correct.
You know, what was the Commission's goals? What do you remember the activity being? And if, even if you remember some of this before being on it, if you feel like you can talk competently about the first 3 or 4 years of the Commission's existence, you know, tell me what that was like. How did it work? What did they place on the front of their agenda, kind of thing?
Well, one of the front things on the agenda was to get an enforceable act, which gave the Commission some authority other than just moral authority. Second thing, we did studies as to the treatment of blacks in education and in public education, particularly with which we were concerned. We did studies with regard to black graduates, how they were faring in that. We issued studies which were performed which would show the economic effect of discrimination in Kentucky and how it could be bettered. But a whole lot of that next 2 years was doing lobbying with the legislators and with the respective governors until we could get what at that time was the finest Kentucky Civil Rights Act of any state. At that point, it was a very, very good act.
When you sought, when the Commission sought the enforcement power, it sounds to me then like prior to that you could just study and inform. Is
that's
that
right? We did studies. We attended meetings. We urged moderation at the very least and acceptance at the very best. And but basically, we knew that we had to have enforcement power so that violations could be enforced by hearings and trials and. And the granting of damages, which we did a great deal of in subsequent years.
Well, do you recall the way in which the Civil Rights Act of Kentucky became law? Do you know the lobbying? You know, give me a little summary of that to the best of your knowledge. Was there any opposition?
Yes, there was considerable opposition, but there was a Civil Rights March in '64. I was not involved in that because I was in a trial somewhere. Where Martin Luther King came, and in Frankfort they had that march. His brother would come and speak in the area as well. Gradually, I think there was a groundswell, which I can't remember the vote, but which I think was very pleasing to persons in the South to see that a Southern state could adopt such a strong ordinance and statute.
Were there any interest groups or I guess I don't know the specifics of the 66 Act, but it pretty much paralleled the national one, didn't it?
It did.
Public accommodations and...
Public accommodations, employment, public accommodation was a big thing there.
Did you find much opposition from, like, hotel and restaurant owners?
Well, we had the very first case. I remember I was, 32 years old, and we had all these distinguished people on the commission, and the very first case was a public accommodations case in Louisville, and so since it was the first one, they had it out at the fairground, a huge room with all the press, and everybody was there. And I remember, I was just a member, Reverend Sampson, who was a black minister from Louisville, was chair, I believe. Paul Oberst, a distinguished constitutional lawyer from UK, was on the panel, and they said, well, who's going to conduct this hearing? And they said, well, who's had the last trial in court? And of course, I was the one. So we decided, Reverend Sampson said, ask me to do that. And I said, well, don't we have Professor Oberst do it? And so we had an agreement that I would preside at that first hearing. And Professor Oberst would handle all factual and evidential questions, and he would handle all constitutional questions. And so we conducted that. About midway in that hearing, a question came up for the defendant. It was a case of a bar in Louisville failing to serve a black customer who came in with a white customer. And so at one point, counsel for the commission asked, what did you say at that point? And he said, I don't want to answer that. Well, nobody knew the extent of our authority. You'd go to the circuit court, you'd get the sheriff to serve somebody. So me and I just hit my gavel and said, you will answer that question. And he did, and of course that made the case for the other side. So we took a break about 15 minutes after that. And Oberst and others asked me, said, David, what were you going to do if he didn't answer the question? I said, I don't have the slightest idea, but I didn't want him to know that.
So. Right, so there was like, not necessarily, did you have like, could you put him in contempt or anything?
Yeah,
or
the basic form was, and nobody had ever done it, that you would take it to circuit court and raise the question with the circuit court and have the circuit court make a ruling on it. Because cases for the Kentucky Commission could always be appealed to the circuit court, and many were.
Either way, by you
either
guys
way.
Or the
That's correct.
Or the defendant
yeah,
in the claim.
Right. And my goal was, and I think this was accomplished much to my pleasure, was to be able to hold fair hearings without a lynching group coming in to lynch somebody who had lynched somebody else. And we did that. There were many, many cases which were dismissed after hearings that the complainant is not always right, and the respondents, in fact, were right. And that got to be more and more the case when we started dealing with gender matters. The Act dealt with religious discrimination. We had some extremely interesting cases dealing with religious discrimination. For example, I remember a case where a woman wanted to wear a dress and not pants and work in a factory. And her religion said that she couldn't wear pants or trousers. And of course, the safety aspect of it was, if you're there in that factory, you get your cotton at one of those punch presses or something, you're in real trouble. We had another case where a Seventh-day Adventist, I believe it was directed to answer the telephone at this particular business of Merry Christmas, and did not wish to do that, and they did not accommodate her by having her answer Happy Holidays, because the owners were so Christian that they believed Happy Holidays was demeaning to the Christian side and her religious beliefs. And we've had numerous cases, married couples. At that point, intermarriage was practically unheard of, and I'd always stated publicly that we never solved our racial problem until we intermarried with one another, and we all become generally one color. And that's coming about now. But at that point, if you advocated, and we had an anti-miscegenation statute on it, made it a crime to intermarry. So there were many, many things that we were involved in, and things I were pleased with is that we decided to use our own commissioners as hearing officers and not to hire professional hearing officers, because we felt we had a commitment from these people. And so a lot of my work was in training lay commissioners to sit on panels where they were making judgments. And I think they're getting back to that now. So, but those were things we did which were a little unusual, because a lot of commissions just hired a professional examiner to go ahead and have the hearing and report back the findings and send the transcripts. But we always felt that credibility was so important that we needed to have commissioners there.
Now, when I've done my, when I've looked at your minutes, the commission's minutes and stuff, it looked like there was probably quarterly meetings through the 60s. Does that sound right?
Yeah, in the early 60s, certainly. And then later on in the 60s, I think we got into monthly meetings.
Okay.
But initially, there was an office in the Capitol, just one office with an executive director and one employee, and we came together quarterly. And then we would have committees, which might be more often. As at that time, and it hasn't changed, I think the per diem may have been either $35 or $50 at that time. When you just went to get you down there and back. That's correct.
Because they're coming from all over. I noticed, too, that sometimes the meetings would be at a state park, or they weren't always in Frankfort or Louisville, probably most were.
Yeah, most were. Well, once the commission became enforcement powers, it decided that it needed to have an office in Louisville, which was the seat of the highest level of minorities and percentage-wise. So it opened in Louisville, and they continued with an office in Frankfort. And then later on in the 80s, I believe, they closed the office in Frankfort and had the Louisville office.
Well, if you would, maybe sometime between the time you first got on the commission and even when you left it later on in the 80s, what was the difference between the commission, the group of commissioners, and who I guess they were kind of the guiding force, and then the staff itself who did the real day-to-day work?
Yeah, they did the grunt work. The commission is set up under statute to be nine commissioners. I believe it's nine, maybe it was 11. One from each of the Supreme Court judicial districts, and then and there were seven of those, and then two at large. They were required to come from all kinds of backgrounds, labor, union backgrounds, business, professional, civil rights organizations, religious organizations. It always turned out very well that they did that. Some of the great acquaintances I've made were on that commission, either in the labor movement or in the religious movement, and the black religious movement, and these sorts of things. And we made policy. Now, once decided what the mission should be, and adopted mission statements initially. But then, and that was with a very small staff. But then, of course, when we got enforcement powers, you had to increase the staff. I think when I left, we had maybe six lawyers on the staff. The executive director was a lawyer as well. And of course, there are very tight guidelines as to how you have to process these complaints and within the times you have to process them. So the commission staff did that and did that well. You could lose a case simply by not processing it, finding the probable cause or determination that there was no probable cause. So.
I would like to talk about Galen Martin a little bit. But maybe before we get into him, I guess he was the most memorable person that you worked with. Is that the case?
I said at a testimony before a Blue Ribbon panel recently that was looking about changes in the commission that I thought that Kata Martin had done more for civil rights in Kentucky in the last half century than any other Caucasian. No doubt about that. And Galen was dedicated, and he was bright. And he still is. Galen's still alive, as you know, but he's incapacitated.
Is that right?
He had a terrible, terrible bicycle accident in North Carolina about 3 years ago. And since that time, he has not been able to communicate.
Really? I talked to him probably in 99 or 2000 last, and he's
sharp,
tip top. Yeah.
Oh, yeah. And in the course of my work on the commission, we had complaints against Galen.
Yeah, let's talk about him now. You knew him barely, I guess, partly from the Berea relationship, and then I guess one of my first questions would be, to what degree did he run the show, and to what degree did the commission run the show? You know, what was the balance of power between the commission and him, and was there ever any disagreements? How did that work out?
Well, Galen initially ran the show. There wasn't any question he was needed to run the show, and he did. But he tried to choose, or help choose, really good people for the commission, and he wasn't recommending persons be appointed that could not be challenging to him on policy matters. But with his supreme dedication, he's originally from West Virginia, went to Berea, got involved in this, and I remember, I think he got his master's and some programs through the South, which he, public administration, and later he got his law degree at the University of Louisville. And Galen was just top notch. But Galen had a way of doing things which some people took offense with. And he was involved terrifically in the Jefferson County busing matter. And the Kentucky Commission was involved in that. While I'm 200 miles away from there, the Kentucky Commission was taking part, and I had very little to do in that, but he was heavily involved, and he was threatened in this whole thing. Galen did well. Over the years, he got even stronger people on the commission. And unbelievably, there were complaints of Galen as being racist in some of the promotions and some of the steps that he took within the commission.
Who would have charged that? Maybe not a person's
employees,
name, but...
Employees within the commission. The commission employees, members of the staff.
Was there any foundation to that?
Well, there was enough foundation. We had to have a hearing, and here I am as chairman of the commission, and the best personal friend of Galen Martin happened to have a hearing on those matters, and we concluded after the hearing that he should resign. We did not make any findings that, in fact, he was racist in his approach, but we made findings that some of the statements he made could be interpreted because they were strong statements. He made adjustments and appointments to various positions based upon the quality of performance, which some have indicated that an African American could have done the job just as well. And unfortunately, he made some statements that he didn't believe that was the case. And he and I dealt with it for a long time. And Galen, in fact, had advised me to it a couple times that he was going to resign. He was going to take the heat off and resign. And then he didn't. I had been told that he would resign and pass it on to commissioners. Don't deal with this situation, but he's going to resign. And he came back and said, no, I'm not going to resign. And I don't remember telling David that. So we had to have the hearing. And my vote was probably instrumental in his being removed. And for a period of time, well after that, neither Galen nor his wife spoke to him. He was very hurt and very upset about it. We had to select a new executive director, which we did, and then we had to finally select another one, which we did. Galen went to work with the Fair Housing Group in Louisville and continued on his work in this field. But he and I did, he just stopped talking. He just couldn't communicate to me. He thought I had not done well by him.
What year roughly was that he was asked to resign?
I'm not certain of that. It would have been in the 80s when I was chair. I was mayor and finished being mayor of the city of Ashland. I completed my term in 79, and I was immediately back, asked to come back on the commission and serve the 80s. So it would have been mid-80s,
okay.
Mid to late 80s. And Galen subsequently ran for Congress and was unsuccessful. But there's always a silver lining. In 2000, when the Kentucky Commission selected its first class Hall of Fame, the Kentuckians from Civil Rights, both Galen and I were selected.
Did you just talk to him then?
Oh, yes. And
you patched things up?
We patched things up. He had pictures taken together. There have been pictures in the Berea alumnus of us together. He sent me some pictures of us together. As soon as I got there, he wanted to patch this up, and others had tried for years before, and so we patched it up. I still say he was the most effective person, Caucasian, in civil rights in the Commonwealth in the last half century.
Well, let's go back before that incident. You know, what was the relationship between the commission and him, and I guess how much of this was a driving force? Was he seen by members, you know, other politicians, the governors and such? Was he seen as a, you know, what was the perspective on him, let's say up through to 1975 or so?
I think it was good. He was a tough, I mean, he didn't give any, he had no liberty with things were generally black and white, and that's not a pun in this case, but they were generally black and white. And he was terrific with regard to courts and court appearances on the busing matters. He was very strong. He wanted to expand the powers of the commission, some of which were accomplished in going to other fields. So, you know, we get into race, and get into gender, and we get into age, and this sort of thing. And Galen was doing his job, but Galen, for a period of time, changed. He wanted leaves of absences, which we granted. He wanted to go to Colorado and ski and be a ski instructor, which was not. And he was always an outdoors person, thus his recent injury at over 70, riding a bicycle in the mountains of North Carolina. And he did all that, and then we would work along, and he agreed to make some changes and get more oversight. And he didn't. I think Galen was having some problems during that period of time, and we accommodated him for a long time. But then in addition to that, there came the complaints that not only was he not overseeing it, but that some of his actions were interpreted as racist, and I don't think it was supported by racist by some of the members of the staff, and the staff actually turned on Galen. And at that point, we need to make the change. But he's always perceived, I believe, as the person who has no. I don't believe it'd be possible for Galen to take actions which would be racist. I can see his management style, particularly when he got out of it for 3 or 4 months at a time and wanted further leeway to accomplish this, and he wanted to write this sort of thing. And because of his background, we gave him all of these things and finally came to a head.
Sounds like the recommendation for him to resign might have been as much to make sure that the organization ran smoothly more than to call him guilty. Is that?
I think that's right. Okay. There was no finding of guilt on racism, but we all agreed that Caitlin was no longer.
Understood.
I say we all. I think there were 2 or 3 votes not to change.
Who else stands out in your mind, either on the commission or staff member?
All the staff members. Last week I went to the Hall of Fame induction. Because I was a judge, nobody knows I'm a judge. But John Johnson was on our staff as a young lawyer, and John was just adopted. He is a senior vice president of the NAACP in Baltimore. He's gone on to do that. Sam DeShazer was an excellent lawyer. We had some very, very good lawyers. We had some very good members. Paul Ober stands out as being very good. Ann Weatherford, whose husband was president of Berea College, was vice chair when I was chair of the commission. Bob Schwimm, who's a distinguished professor of law at the University of Kentucky, was there. Bill Billingsley, who was a AFL CIO organizer in Northern Kentucky, was on the commission when I was there. It was excellent. Lady by the name of Fanny Rosenbaum from Louisville was on the commission, and she was a Jewish member of the commission, and she and I became very, very close, very close friends. She recently passed away, but she was outstanding.
Do you remember Jim Crumlin?
Sure.
Tell me what you remember about him.
Yeah, Reverend Jim Crumlin, who was also an attorney from Louisville. I remember Jim. Jim and I served on many panels. Matter of fact, we had Jim come to Ashland in the last 2 or 3 years of his life to speak here. Jim was outstanding. He was great. Went to sleep occasionally because Jim was getting old, but he was great. He gave us a wealth of background and experience.
Okay. me a little bit, and I've met him.
Have you met
him? Yeah, and I've interviewed him. He's been interviewed in one of these same interviews, right, at his house, actually.
Right.
And tell me a little bit more about his personality. You know, how did he handle things?
Jim was gregarious, to say the least. He sort of went right to the heart of matters. He was a very, very successful trial lawyer in Louisville, doing a lot of criminal work. And Jim dealt with the type of people and knew the type of people that needed permission. And we needed Jim. So he had a legal background, and he was a minister, and he had that background as well, plus a wonderful outgoing personality. And sometimes when you have your hearings as to how you decide cases, Jim would be the first ones to reach a conclusion on a case. And he did a lot of that as not just because of his background, but just gut reaction was always very good. A wonderful thing.
Yeah. Okay. You know, I've looked at some of the cases, and you'll see where the they come from, or it'll be, you know, somebody's name versus,
right,
you know, the local bar and grill or whatever. Do you know of any particular region or city of Kentucky where it seemed like there was a high level of either racial harmony or racial strife? You know, is there any, you know, I don't want you to overgeneralize, but is there any place that seemed to come up all the time as having racial problems in the state?
I would say not. Okay. I would say not. I can remember our second case was a case down in the western part of the state. I believe it was in Franklin. And a Vietnam veteran had returned, black. He was not permitted to swim in the city pool. And John Johnson just recently reminded me that last week when he said, oh, I remember David going down to that hearing, so we didn't get a very sweet reception. But of course, we found that that was, you know, a gross violation of the statute. But I've provided at hearings on economics gender cases involving Owensboro Hospital, where the later ordered about $300,000 in damages to females who were not making as much as male orderlies, and I heard about 5 days of that. We had cases involving, which I heard in the University of Law, Kentucky Law School, involving discrimination in the mine against women, and two women were felt to be unlucky in the mines, and this type of thing. We have a full, complete hearing on that. I've held hearings in Pikeville and in Middlesboro involving employment cases in Louisville involving a couple who adopted children, and they were of different race, and they were excluded from some clubs and these types of things. So I don't think there's a particular place. You probably see more cases out of those areas where the minority of black employees is greater. Yes.
Do you ever feel that the Commission on Human Rights or the staff, do you ever feel that they went too far? Was there ever a time when they were too aggressive in trying to desegregate or?
No, I don't think so.
Okay.
I think that's what really makes the Commission go, is these matters being brought before the Commission. And I'm sure the staff was unhappy with it sometimes, and we didn't follow their directions. And follow those. Even Galen was unhappy sometimes because he felt our duty was to give a broad view, and he was truly an activist, and he needed good commissioners who were also interested but not necessarily activists to assure due process to everybody.
Yeah. Now, just real quick, if you could sum this up for me, you were on the commission, I think, when the Louisville busing suit arose. Now, what was that? You know, I understand it basically, but what was the, you know, was the commission in the right position to address that? What was the reaction to it? Just what do you recall from the whole Louisville?
Okay, I was not heavily involved because that required hands-on folks who were doing it. Galen Martin was most heavily involved. He took exactly the wrong position. I agree. He took the right position on the busing and going into federal courts, and ultimately got a very, very good decision there. History will tell us whether it was the proper thing to do now when we have this, but it was very hot. We would have people come to our commission meetings who were objecting, people from out in Ferndale, as I recall, maybe the areas and this sort of thing. It was tough times, and but I'm very pleased with what the commission, the position they took. It was a very aggressive position, and I think it needed to be done. But we were looking at other communities like Charlotte and what they were doing. We were bringing in people. Gary, can't think of his last name, from Harvard.
Orfield,
yeah. Gary Orfield came in twice, talked to our group and talked with us, and give a considerable amount of help for that. And I well remember meeting with him and having lunch with him and learning a great deal from him. So we were trying to take an approach, but it was a heated issue.
Did the commissioners generally agree with the suit? I mean,
yeah, I think so.
Yeah.
We may have had somebody from out of the state that didn't agree, but they were generally from places which had very small minority representation and would object to that. And always got back to me in my first 16 years of life, 17 years of life, with school lined up in Ashland, Kentucky, to see my friends have to pass 5 schools to go down to Booker T. Washington, to see my friends now in Greenup and other places having to be bused past their own towns and into other towns to come to one school. That's all thought all blacks. And busing seemed to me to be a reasonable antidote for that situation at the time. And I think we benefited from it.
Was there anything else you want to tell me about your experience?
No, I'll be glad to talk to you any other time if you need to.
Okay, I appreciate it.
Great.